Although the end of life is a universal phenomenon, it's a new experience for everyone who is dying. Even though families may have had experience with a dying loved one, it's different every time. Add to that the complexities that dementia may bring, and we are often faced with many decisions, ones that are bound to raise both ethical and emotional challenges. This morning, as part of our continuing series, Difficult Decisions in Healthcare, I'm joined by Dr. Gregory Eastwood, Professor of Bioethics and Humanities and Professor of Medicine at Upstate Medical University, and Dr. Sharon Brangman, Professor of Medicine and the Division Chief for Geriatrics at Upstate Medical University, specializing in Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. Dr. Brangman is also the current president of the American Geriatric Society. Welcome, Drs. Eastwood and Brangman.
Good morning.
Nice
Thank you
here.
So much for coming this morning. Dr. Eastwood, let's just start with clearly that the end of life is very difficult for the person, obviously, but as well as for the family. From your vast experience as a physician and healer, what are some of your thoughts or personal observations about that time of life for the family?
And my vast experience of living about 7 decades, too.
Exactly.
That's probably the most relevant experience.
Okay.
Well, you know, life is complicated enough. And when you get older, it gets more complicated. I think our listeners can probably relate to that, even young ones. And to have illness and reduction in your mental abilities on top of that complicates things a lot. So I'm really glad to have Dr. Sharon Brangman here with us today. She and I have worked together on a number of things over the last several years, and I appreciate her being here. I thought, though, before we went further, being Sunday morning and all, we might have a little biblical scripture. I have a couple from one from Ecclesiastes, which most people are pretty familiar with, I'm sure, the third chapter. To everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under the heaven, and a time to be born, a time to die. I like that because it verifies that there's a time for everything. And sometimes in contemporary medicine, we don't really know when it's time to die, as we will get into in a few minutes. And it's also, this is helpful because it allows loved ones to accept death if you take the essence of what Ecclesiastes is telling us. Another is from near the end of Genesis 49, and it says, "And when Jacob had made an end of commanding his sons," this is from the King James Version, and it really means giving instructions to his sons. "So when Jacob had made an end of giving instructions to his sons, he gathered up his feet into the bed and yielded up the ghost and was gathered unto his people." Now, this is probably one of the earliest examples of someone who first accepts imminent death, very relevant today. Second, taking care of business, he instructed his sons, and then prepared to die, and then he died. The only thing that's different from our subject today is, as far as we know, Jacob wasn't demented, but in all other respects, this is relevant. So it's a very trying time for life, as you point out. We all die, but it's a unique experience for each of us when it happens and our families.
Dr. Brangman, in your experience, it seems to me, I'd love you to comment on this. There have been changes in our perspective of death and birth as we've moved those most natural processes into sterile places like hospitals, out of homes. And I read a little article, actually, by Dr. David Duggan, who is affiliated with this institution, talking about his father's passing and how his father, who had been a physician, made the point that when we are in a hospital, we often have this notion that we can sustain life interminably, forever, and it dangerously promotes the concept or the false presumption of immortality.
I think that's a very, very important concept to kind of grasp. Because we have so much technology and we have these big hospital structures, a lot of doctors, nursing staff, everyone assumes that we can actually stop the process, that we have tubes and technology and computers and things that can defy what's a natural process. And I think this is augmented by television shows. There are so many television shows where people go in and they have a cardiac arrest, and within minutes they're sitting up and talking and they're well made up and they go back to their normal life. So I think that a lot of the public watches this and they incorporate it And they think that hospitals are like television shows, and within 30 minutes, you can take a dire situation, a near-death experience, pull someone back from the brink, and they're perfectly normal again. And so I often, when I'm talking to families about the end-of-life process, I have to debunk a lot of the myths that are out there.
And clearly, if this process was taking place in our homes, the way it used to be. I mean, I'm not advocating going back, you know, 40, 50 years necessarily, or 100 years.
But it's better to die at home than in the hospital.
Right.
That's right.
But then those around you would also see that there was a natural process to it, as opposed to the tubes and all the lines and everything that really, first of all, are frightening, I think, to the family members as well as possibly the patient.
Well, I think we lost the skills on how that's supposed to be done.
Yeah.
Because everything has been moved out of the home, and there's been no one to kind of pass on those activities that would happen. You know, you might have recipes. You know what happens on holidays because you've watched families do it. But the birth process and the dying process have now been removed from families, from the personal experience, and are now done by others in a hospital setting.
Well, add to that, the picture changes when we add dementia. And we're really running out of time before the break, but just quickly, how does it change?
Well, dementia is a foundational illness. You know, whether you want to call it Alzheimer's disease or mini strokes, it really directs all medical care. And what I always tell my students is that if someone has dementia, that impacts their hypertension, the way you manage their diabetes, the way you manage their medications, their arthritis. And it certainly impacts the way we talk about things at the end of life. And because it can span 10 or 15 years, we have a long goodbye in a way. And many families tell me they feel as though their loved one dies twice. Mm. Initially in the early stages when they have changes in their behavior and their personality and their daily routines. And then towards the end when they physically die. So I think it's one of those diseases where families and caregivers really experience all of the valleys, so to speak, of a disease, of a chronic illness.
Well, hold that thought. We're going to come right back. We have to take a short break. We'll continue our discussion about the challenges of life and dementia. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to HealthLink on Air, FM News Radio 106.9 and 570 WSYR. Welcome back to HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with Drs. Gregory Eastwood and Sharon Brangman. And we're talking about the difficult decisions surrounding end of life, especially when dementia is part of the picture. And Dr. Brangman gave us some beginning feeling for that. Dr. Eastwood, you had
a
thought.
Yes, I was fascinated by something she said toward the end of the last session, and that was about personality changes. And I think any of us who have observed demented patients have observed that. And the question I asked her, and I'll ask it here, does dementia sort of release something so that personality changes really represent an exaggeration of something that was there all along, or do the personality changes really represent changes, mm-hmm. Some fundamental difference in a person's personality, or maybe something else?
Or a mixture.
Well, the thing about Alzheimer's disease is that it's a very individual process. And so when we approach a patient, it's really from their point of departure, so
to
speak.
It's kind of where they are.
It's where they are. So I've seen patients along the entire spectrum. People who are very quiet and meek and mild suddenly becoming aggressive and cursing and embarrassing their family. I've seen people that were very mean and stubborn and nobody wanted to approach them. In fact, they had damaged a lot of family relationships, who are now cooperative and friendly, and can be a challenge to get family members to step up and help with care. People lose their motivation frequently in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease, so they may not do activities they used to enjoy. Or I've had more than one patient who were chronic smokers. We couldn't do anything to get them to smoke, and when they got into the midst of Alzheimer's disease, they forgot all about smoking. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard to come up with a firm and hard rule. We know that personalities can change, and that it can sometimes be for the better or it sometimes can be worse. Some people lose their disinhibition or that filter that we all develop as we get older. I kind of give an analogy of a little kid who says whatever comes to their mind and often embarrasses their parents. Well, there are some forms of dementia in particular where people lose that screen and they say things that are very embarrassing.
And clearly would cause all kinds, as you mentioned, all kinds of social ramifications. Right.
So this is a disease. It's a terminal illness. We can manage the symptoms, and it spans a long period of time in many people. Well, so each stage has its own kind of tasks that we have to deal with.
Well, clearly, with that in mind and the fact that it can exist for so long, there are so many difficult decisions along the way then during that time frame. And clearly, if the person is perhaps unable to be clear about their own destiny or what they want, it falls on the family then, or anyone who's engaged in this process with them as some kind of a caregiver's system, to help with those kinds of decisions. And I guess let's talk about what some of those decisions could be besides just the end of life, you know, at the very terminal point of life. I mean, things like independence. How does one make a decision that someone can no longer live on their own?
Well, those are very tough questions because often the patient and the family are both in denial and they don't want to deal with the issue. Or one is more motivated than the other, and frequently the adult child is more motivated to do something to make sure their parent is safe, and the parent is saying, I'm fine the way I am. So we have a lot of tough kind of decisions to make. So in the early stages, one of the reasons why it's so important to make the diagnosis early is because we can often include, and in fact we encourage the patient to participate in these discussions.
With the notion that at that point perhaps they are still able.
They're still able. It's not always willing because people are in shock and denial. They don't want to talk about it. Maybe talking about it will make it real. So some people don't want to deal with those decisions. But if they can, we do talk about what kinds of care would you want.
Well, we're talking about decisions. Maybe this is a good time to ask you, Sharon, are there things we can decide to do to prevent it? You know, there's this popular lore about doing crossword puzzles or keeping your mind occupied. And also there's some evidence that just being overweight or at least a big waistline might be correlated with development of Alzheimer's. I don't know if we can decide to reduce our waistline or not, but what do you think about preventing it?
Well, since we don't have a cure right now, we do see some associations with people who are overweight, who have diabetes and high blood pressure, especially if it's not under good control. And these are problems that often crop up in middle age. We do have emerging research that indicates that the more physically active and the more exercise you do, the better it is for your brain as well as for your heart. And even people with Alzheimer's disease who exercise do better than those who don't. So we often recommend that people exercise and eat well, but that's what they expect to hear from their docs. And
yeah, it's actually true prophylactically
it's
for all
true for everyone.
Everyone.
Yeah. By the time they come to us, they're not too interested in hearing that at that point. They want to know what they can do to make everything go away and make it back to normal. And that's the challenge, because crossword puzzles and all of those things, although they may be interesting, they don't necessarily prevent you from losing brain power or getting these diseases as we get older.
I have an ethical question here in this context, and that is, if a person is beginning that road to dementia, but they're still able, whatever that means, that they're still, you know, compos mentis, they can make decisions. Ethically, when you have to make certain kinds of medical decisions for different kinds of intervention, is it important to incorporate not only their will, obviously their wishes, but how much is it important to incorporate the wishes of their family members at that point, knowing full well that those people may be, in fact, responsible down the road? I mean, how do you handle that?
Well, generally, if somebody is able to make decisions for themselves and we think that they have the capacity to make those decisions, then our conversation is with that person. And it may impact their family members, and that's a very real possibility, but That is their choice and their ability to make. We can't take that away from them.
But at some point, they're no longer able. And at that point, is it an ethical issue at that point? Dr. Issa, what do you think?
Well, I think for convenience of conversation, we say at some point. But I think, as Dr. Brangman intimated, and in reality, it's a sliding point. And the capacity to make decisions begs the question, what are the decisions that you're making?
Right.
And we know that many people can make some decisions. I use the examples, three stages of decisions. One example is, I may be able to make a decision what I'm going to have for lunch tomorrow, but I can't make a decision regarding some complex medical issue.
Whether to have surgery.
Whether to have surgery or something like that, or to take out an endotracheal tube that's keeping me alive, you know, some fairly dramatic thing. Other people may actually be in that stage of mental compromise or dementia, where they actually can appoint a healthcare proxy agent, someone who would act on their behalf. This isn't that common, but in any event, but they can't make complex decisions. So we have to ask, what's the decision that we're going to make?
But both the decision and what state they're in is what you're saying.
And what's the consequences of the decision? If you pick the wrong thing for lunch, that doesn't have a big impact on your life or your health. But if you make a decision not to have surgery, or to have surgery, that can have a significant impact.
Well, let's just ask that real quick. Basically, if someone is demented, clearly, and it is a terminal illness, and there's no hope for any kind of reprieve, so to speak, do we do things like open heart surgery? Do we do things like, you know, brain surgery, if it seems indicated from a medical perspective? I don't mean to treat the dementia. I mean,
well, it's a very individual thing, and I don't think we can make a blanket statement. It depends on that person's quality of life, how much cognitive and physical function they have, and what the impact of that surgery might have on their disease course. Because we know that a lot of people, certainly with Alzheimer's disease or other dementias, have problems after anesthesia or after major surgery. They may not come back to the same level of brain function that they were before. So these are decisions that have to be made in a very individualized way, kind of looking at the whole person and their picture and what they would wish.
So you really need someone like yourself, a good guide. I mean, besides someone with great medical expertise, you need someone who can help both the patient and the people around the patient make those kinds of decisions, weighing each of the issues and the potential consequences.
Yes, and that's the challenge, because everyone is different, and just like we are all individuals, we may value different things. And I have so many friends who tell me, oh, I want you to be like Dr. Kevorkian and help me in the end. And it's interesting that when I see so many people in the end, they don't want Dr. Kevorkian. They want to live, but they want to live with a good quality of life.
Right. Well, we have to take another short break, but we'll be right back to continue this discussion. Please stay with us. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to HealthLink on Air, FM News Radio, 106.9 and 570 WSYR.